I'm Julie Burstein, and I'm here on this Friday afternoon for Leonard Lopate. Most weekends, I get a chance to take a walk with my friend Kate. Or should I say Kate and I follow her terrier Ramsey on his walk. He definitely sets the pace, racing to get to the park, until he's waylaid by some delicious smell on a tree or a fire hydrant, or maybe just even a patch of grass that's grown taller than all the others. I've always been curious about the world Ramsey experiences, which seems to have diversions that are very different from mine. What he's looking for, I've learned, are pheromones, which are all around us. Creatures of all kinds, from the smallest bacteria to the largest mammals, are engaged in silent and invisible communication using pheromones. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about pheromones, what they are and how they work, and we're also going to take your calls, too. In a few minutes, we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. I'm joined by Dr. Tristram Wyatt of Oxford University, who has written a book titled Pheromones and Animal Behavior, published by Cambridge University Press, and he's on the phone. And Dr. Stuart Feierstein, professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at Columbia University. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I wish I was in New York.
I wish you were too.
Me too, Tristan.
Lovely to have you on the phone. Can we start by explaining what the basic issue is? And so I'd like to ask you, Dr. Wyatt, what is a pheromone?
Well, a pheromone is a molecule used for chemical communication. And the definition is 50 years old this year, and it comes from the word pherin, to transfer, and hormone, to excite. So the idea was transferred excitement between animals. And the full definition is substances which are secreted to the outside by an individual and received by another individual or individuals of the same species. So it's communication within the species. And when it reaches the other animal, it releases a specific reaction, so a behavior like a dog responding to a smell, or it might be a slightly longer lasting thing, a developmental process.
And so that's, you know, when I watch Ramsey, often he'll sniff something and then roll around in it. So is that the experience that it's eliciting is the effect?
Indeed, it's kind of gross, but yes. a better example of a dog pheromone is when a male dog is responding to a female at a great distance, and what he's responding to is the female pheromone. And we still don't know what that is, but it's very powerful, as every dog owner would know.
How were these pheromones discovered?
Well, it had been supposed for a very long time that something invisible, probably a chemical, was involved. And we can go back to the ancient Greeks, who knew about dogs and female dogs and their attraction. Fast forwarding to the first hunters, and they knew that you could follow prey and you could attract prey with the pheromones given off by one of the other sexes. And there are accounts in the 17th century of if you're stung by a bee, you should pull out the sting because other bees will come otherwise and sting you, attracted by the pheromone. But it really hadn't been identified. We couldn't be sure that there was a chemical. And it waited actually until 1959, the year that the word pheromone was coined, for Adolf Buddendant to finally announce the first chemical identification of a pheromone, which was the sex pheromone of the silk moth. And it had taken him and his team something like 20 years to identify the molecule. It had taken a very long time. It's actually quite a hard thing to do.
Dr. Feierstein, can you talk about these molecules? What form do they take? What's their composition?
Well, they're all almost entirely, I think entirely, what we could call organic molecules. The nice thing about the olfactory system, the sense of smell, which of course includes the ability to perceive pheromones, is that instead of using that whole scary-looking periodic table of
we only need a little part of it.
We're only interested in carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, and occasionally maybe a little sulfur just to stink things up occasionally. So it's much easier to think about, at least with just those few molecules. But in spite of that, because of the particular properties of carbon atoms, they can combine and recombine in just an endless variety of ways, producing then an almost limitless sorts of chemicals, which are mostly strings of carbon atoms, all strung together in different configurations and shapes and associated hydrogen and oxygen atoms, mostly that go with them, and occasionally nitrogen. Pardon me. So these include everything from DNA and RNA all the way up to proteins and other small molecules that give roses the smell of rose and lavender smell, and also, as it turns out, pheromones.
Now, does a pheromone, you talk about these wonderful smells, roses and lavenders. There are some smells that Ramsey, and I'm going to use him again, is attracted to that I can actually smell. But are pheromones actually a smell? Can we recognize them with that sense and say, oh, that smells like the pheromone of a, you know, whatever? Or is it something that works on a different level in the way we sense it?
Most of them seem, I think, Tristram, you'll agree with me, most of them seem not to have a particular perception or an obvious perception to another species. But we do occasionally smell the pheromones of other species. The best example, I suppose, being a chemical called androstenone, which is a boar or pig pheromone, but which at least some portion of the human population, about 35% of us, I think, if I'm right, detect at quite a high level. That is, if you're in a room with even a drop of this stuff and you're sensitive to it, then you're quite sickened by it. It smells like stale, sweaty urine.
How interesting. But not everybody can pick this up.
No. So many of us are what we call anosmic to it, which is we just simply don't smell that particular chemical. We don't have whatever molecular machinery seems to be necessary to do it.
Are there other cross species? You know, this is a pig or boar pheromone. Are there other ways, Dr. Wyatt, where something from one species might be able to sense another species?
Well, sometimes it's just by chance. So there are some male moth pheromones which we can smell. There are some very special evolved relationships where a predator has evolved the same sensitivity to its prey's pheromones as the prey itself. So as the prey animals, say bark beetles, animals that are living in trees, are calling to each other, bark beetle predators are homing on those signals and using them as a way of finding food.
There is a kind of level of sophistication in nature that is always awe-inspiring.
And then there are also some quite quirky situations. Tristram, you must tell the story of elephants and moths, right?
Well, that's a weird one. Quite recently, I guess in the mid-90s, somebody discovered, this was Beth Rasmussen working in Oregon and Wendell Roloffs in Cornell in New York State, discovered that the Asian female elephant releases in its urine a very powerful sex pheromone, which turns out to be the same small molecule, just a small acetate, a little volatile molecule, that is used by about 140 species of moths. And so this has caused a lot of interest. And of course, one of the worries was, well, why weren't moths attracted to elephants and elephants attracted to moths? And of course, the story turned out that female moths produce tiny amounts of this molecule. So male elephants simply don't notice. They're looking for gallons of this material. And in the other direction, the female elephant probably wouldn't notice, but if male moths are not attracted to female elephants because they're actually attracted to a specific blend. Because although there are lots of molecules that can be used as pheromones that are volatile and so forth, the way that animals avoid confusion between species is by mixing them up in particular blends. And so each male moth species, or the males of each species, were looking for a particular combination. And female elephants don't give that off, and nor do females of other moth species. So that's how they know they're going for the right female. So it's an example of the way that the same molecule can be used by different species, but in fact we don't get confusion.
Is that part of the reason why this was so challenging to detect, is that there's just this endless array of different combinations that these chemicals can make, as you were talking about, Dr. Feierstein?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons, and we should point out here that in fact most pheromones are still unknown. For most species, we have not been able to identify any specific pheromone. Not only are they very varied and therefore difficult to work out, but they're often produced in rather minute quantities. So it's very hard to get them. I think that was the problem with the original identification of a pheromone. You can imagine it came from this moth species, but really in minuscule microliter amounts that were produced.
And wasn't there a story that the only reason he recognized this is he didn't think they had a sense of smell? So was that story, was that a different one, where he eliminated all of the other ways that the moths could be communicating?
Well, that has been part of the story, and it really waited until we had better chemistry, which was starting to come in the 1950s. And in fact, things have been transformed. When Butendandt was identifying the silk moth pheromone, he needed 500,000 female moths to gather enough material for the chemistry of the day to actually identify the molecule. Nowadays, if you knew the kind of molecule you were looking for, you could probably get enough material from a single moth. So things have gone in leaps and bounds in the chemical side over the last 50 years. But you're right, it was one of the things that held things back, because you'd see these animals definitely communicating. And there's a lovely story of fish pheromones, because all this works underwater as well. Noses work underwater just as in air. And von Frisch, who's more famous for the bee dance, was watching fish and seeing that they got alarmed if one of them had a little injury and some things leaked into the water. He could see the behavior, but it has taken another, I guess, 50, 60 years, for almost 80 years, for us to have an idea of what those molecules might be. And as Stuart was saying, as Professor Feierstein was saying, it's partly to do with the concentrations being so small, and that's really a characteristic of pheromones. It's about how sensitive the receivers are. The noses of animals are very sensitive to the compounds, the chemicals that matter. So they're very sensitive to pheromones. And there's a reason, because if they're going to survive, they need to respond.
I'm speaking with Dr. Tristram Wyatt from the Oxford University and Dr. Stuart Feierstein from Columbia University. We're talking about pheromones, and we're going to be taking your questions in a couple of minutes. You can call if you have any questions about pheromones at 212-433-9692. I'm Julie Burstein, and I'm in on this Friday afternoon for Leonard Lopate. Now, we've been talking about pheromones, and you mentioned the way they're used for sexual attraction. And Dr. Wyatt, you've just mentioned alarm. What are the different ways these pheromones are used for communication?
If one thinks of honeybees, in fact, almost all the actions in the hive, apart from the things like the bee dance and some of the things to do with songs with their wings, are all done
songs?
With pheromones.
I didn't know they made songs with their wings. That's very cool.
So they buzz as well. So the buzzing of a hive is also sending messages between the bees. But the female, the queen, when she goes on her nuptial flight, I guess before the honeymoon, she attracts the males, the drones, with a sex pheromone. If they're attacked by a bear or a human poking them with a stick, then the bees will release an alarm pheromone, which attracts other bees to attack the invader, the object invading. There are pheromones which are passed around the colony, which tell the worker bees that the queen is there and laying eggs. So all sorts of aspects of communication with the hive are done with these pheromones. If one thinks of ants, ants leave a trail of pheromones, which other ants can follow to find food and bring it back to the nest. As you go across the animal kingdom, all sorts of things are done by pheromones, by the sense of smell. And as I was mentioning, this is in water and in air. And it really does seem to be almost the universal way of communication. So even if animals can't produce a sound, they're likely to be producing chemicals for communication.
Dr. Feierstein, how ancient are these substances? I've read that bacteria can emit pheromones also, as well as these higher, more evolved creatures.
I don't know that we would use the term pheromone specifically for bacteria, mm-hmm. but certainly bacteria do, as the result of their normal metabolism, they release a variety of chemicals as well, and other bacteria have learned to be sensitive to that as well. There's an important area of the study of bacteria called quorum sensing, where bacteria will remain relatively dormant until there are enough of them to mount, if you will, a large-scale invasion. And then, as a result of passing chemicals around, they have a sense of how many they are. I'm being a little anthropomorphic. But there seems to be some ability to sense how large the colony has grown. And this will throw them into a rapid division sort of behavior. And so they rapidly divide.
And that gives an opportunity, possibly, if we could interfere with that process, of a new kind of drug.
Right.
Now, one thing when I think about this, I think about us, about humans, and wonder, I don't think I'm aware of any of this, although I do know when I've lived in houses with other women, often our menstrual cycles have gone into sync. Are pheromones doing that, too?
Well, it seems to be, and this was work, I guess it was first formalized by Martha McClintock when she was a graduate student in the 70s. And she showed that, yes, women living in close proximity had their cycles synchronize to come together, as it were. And some 20 or so years later, she published a second paper, again in Nature, showing that you could take swabs of the underarm sweat of women in different stages of their own cycles and put that on the upper lip of other women and show that it either speeded up or slowed down the cycles of the women who were receiving these samples. And it was a lovely double-blind study with solvent controls and all the things that you'd hope for. So it's very exciting. That does look as though that is some kind of pheromone, and that's affecting a developmental process. It's affecting the hormones. The frustrating thing is that that was 10 years ago, and still we don't have a candidate compound. Nothing has been published since to say what those molecules might be.
So
I'm
you
sure
have a
there
sense.
Lots of teams working on that, though.
You have a sense that something's happening, but you don't know exactly what it is that's causing this to happen.
And part of the problem, and you were alluding to it earlier, is that often when you're searching for a pheromone, you're searching for needles in haystacks, to use the cliche. It's one or a number of molecules possibly working together among a very large number of potential molecules. Human armpits produce a huge number of chemicals naturally, some of them produced by us, some of them by bacteria. And working out which ones are important in a process is very hard, because it won't necessarily be the ones that are most of, the ones that are in largest quantity. It could be some of those little, small molecules that are in small quantities that are actually doing the work.
And as you pointed out earlier, it could be a blend of them, so that finding one individual one will have no effect. And you have to get the precise blend of them.
You have to understand how they're working together, not just the individual pieces.
Yep.
I'm speaking with Dr. Tristram Wyatt from Oxford University and Dr. Stuart Feierstein at Columbia University about pheromones. We're going to take your questions in just a moment at 212-433-9692. But first, we're going to take a quick break. I'm Julie Burstein, and I'm in today for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Dr. Tristram Wyatt at Oxford University and Dr. Stuart Feierstein at Columbia University about the kind of communication that happens without us really noticing it quite often, called pheromones. We were talking a moment ago about human pheromones. I know I've seen in the back of magazines, buy this product and you will become irresistible to the opposite sex using pheromones. Is this something that could actually be true?
Well, sadly, no. I wish it were.
Well, I'm not so sure about that myself, actually. I mean, wishing it were, because I think what we fail to recognize is it's not just that we would become wildly attractive to the opposite sex, whom we always think of as the models in the magazine, but really we'd become wildly attractive to anyone with a nose. So lacking
of the opposite sex.
Of the opposite sex. So lacking selectivity, really, I'm not sure it would be so wished for.
Yes, subway travel will become hazardous.
Well, I was thinking, Dr. Wyatt, I saw one of your articles and there was a picture of something called bee beards, where someone would put the pheromone of a queen bee and be covered with bees. And I thought, oh, if these pheromones worked, that could be what people would look like.
Yes. Luckily, that only attracts bees.
But, you know, these claims are being made. Are there people out there who are... I guess if they're being advertised, maybe there are people who are actually buying these things.
Well, I guess so. I mean, they're very large numbers. If you Google pheromone, this is mostly what you'll bring up. The sad thing is that although they may have a placebo effect, they could certainly give you confidence, and confidence might lead to results.
Mm-hmm.
So in a bar, that could be useful. But so far, there's nothing that has the same kind of effect on humans as the female dog pheromone has on male dogs. And perhaps we never will find something like that. One of the interesting things for me is not so much whether there's a pheromone that makes us attractive. And one of the things that you sometimes see advertised is this androstenone, mm-hmm. the boar pheromone, the pig pheromone. But that
the one that smells so bad that the people who could actually pick it up would be...
But there's no really good evidence that that is the human pheromone. There isn't anything with the proper bioassay tests that would show that. But certainly smell is involved in a rather different way in who we choose as our partners. And I think there's probably good evidence that we choose people who smell different from us immunologically. And in fact, that was first proposed by somebody in New York, having worked with mice, and he found that the mice were not interested in each other if they smelled the same, if they were genetically identical, because genes also affect smell. And it seems as if, like mice, we go for opposites. We go for people who smell different from us. And there's some nice T-shirt study work where if you get people to wear T-shirts and then get other people to sniff the T-shirts, women go for the T-shirts that were worn by people who were very different from themselves. Immunologically, they are different, and they'd be very poor kidney donors, but excellent partners for having children with.
I'm fascinated by that idea of smelling differently immunologically. What does that mean, that our immune systems are very different?
Well, indeed, it's the area of the genome which, apart from the olfactory genes, which Professor Feinstein might speak about in a moment, it's the most variable part of our genetics, the DNA. And what we seem to go for are other individuals who are especially different from ourselves. And what that means is that our children will be much healthier, much mm-hmm. able, much better able to fight disease, because the immune system's genes have been mixed up again.
We have lots and lots of calls, but Dr. Feinstein, Steve, if you have a...
I was just going to say very quickly, there are other places where pheromones are important as well in this regard, among humans and other animals, and we should point those out. For example, in many body fluids, we find the notion that there probably are pheromones. So you'll notice that your dog, in addition, when it meets another dog, in addition mm-hmm. to sniffing the urogenital area, which is where we think the pheromones collect, also always sniff their mouth. And often their eyes, and there's good evidence that there are pheromones, especially in mice and rats, in their tears and also in their saliva. And so sometimes you need contact in order to pick up the pheromone. And that may be true for humans, that rather than some molecule wafting in the air, it's rather a close encounter that makes the difference.
That may be where kissing came from.
Especially a certain kind of kissing.
Yes. Well, we have a tremendous number of people on the line with questions for both of you, and I'm going to put Sue from Morris Plains. You are on the line. Oh, hold on. Here we go. And Sue, can you hear us? Sue? Yes, you have a question for Dr. Wyatt and Dr. Feinstein?
Yes, I do. My question is related to an agency that I run called the Willow Tree Center. And my first board president was a biologist, and she did some research into willow trees and came back with this story that I've used that I don't know if it's true or not. The statement is that if a willow is attacked by some sort of pest or bug, that it has the ability to somehow change its chemistry to become distasteful to the bug and in hence take care of itself, but further, that it's able to through a pheromone-like release to warn the other willows in the area so that they too change their chemistry and are protected. I use it as an analogy with kids about taking care of yourself and your community. I want to know if I'm telling a lie or not.
No, your story is true. The idea of talking trees, communicating with each other, seemed really quite fanciful initially, but the evidence now is quite good. Whether or not the small molecules, methyl jasminate and a molecule related to aspirin, salicylic acid, seem to be the molecules that are involved, whether or not the communication is almost as much between different parts of the tree. So if some leaves are attacked by an insect, these molecules are given off along with other small green leaf molecules, they're called. The smell of freshly mown hay, for example. They're molecules like that. Part of it may be communicating with other bits of the tree so that the whole tree can now respond and start to produce defensive compounds, bad-tasting compounds to push off other insects. Now, whether or not this is actually communicating to other trees or whether other trees are simply, as it were, listening in or eavesdropping, but whatever the purpose, whatever the function in the first tree, other trees certainly do respond. And if they detect these other molecules, we still don't know how, really, they will themselves start to produce those defensive compounds, even though they haven't been bitten by an insect yet. There's a slightly weird twist to the story, which is each species of caterpillar, each different kind of caterpillar, when it feeds on a leaf, causes the plant, through something in the caterpillar spit, to produce slightly different compounds, different molecules. And the twist in the story is that there are parasitic wasps and predators which are attracted to these specific odors. So another way, it's not just that trees are talking to trees, that trees are calling for help, as it were. And so these natural predators are attracted to find the caterpillars. So it is an amazing story, and no, you're telling a true one.
Ain't Darwin something?
Indeed.
Amazing.
Thank you, Sue. I'd like to go to the question for Wren from Brooklyn. Wren, you have a question that is a kind of connected to this.
Yes. Wanted to ask, is it likely that certain predators over time through the process of evolution, through natural selection, have developed an ability, a particular species of shark, for example, it develops the ability to sense pheromones of its prey. And then, you know, over time, a greater number of those predators would be able to detect those pheromones.
We certainly have quite a few examples of that. In some species, it's a more generalized sense. So in sharks, if they're generalist predators, then they may be going for things that are released by injured fish. They may be going for the more generalized compounds coming from blood. But there are these very specific relationships in some ecological systems where predators focus on just a few species of prey, and yes, they become just as sensitive as the prey are.
This is The Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Julie Burstein, sitting in for Leonard, and I'm speaking with Dr. Tristram Wyatt from Oxford University and Dr. Stuart Feierstein, who's from Columbia University. We are taking your calls, and I'd like to hear from Ankit in Edison, New Jersey. You have a question.
Yes, hi. my question is, you guys were, as both individuals were saying, that they have been able to detect, you know, this, or are looking for a certain kind of molecule. If you know what you're looking for, you can find the right combination or sort of create it. And I was wondering if, along that line, if there has been research or study has been done where they've been able to sort of like maybe simulate or create like a fake pheromone to possibly detect whether how like the cycles are done, or like you were saying with fishes, if they were released a certain kind of pheromone, it would sense the other fishes, like they're in, if this fish is in danger, if you're able to maybe simulate this sort of environment to possibly learn or further expand the research of how the interaction is done.
Well, yep. I think what you're sort of at the edge of is the use of synthetic pheromones or pheromonal materials that we've discovered in certain predator animals, that is pest species, that can be used for pest control. Usually these are used to attract pests, typically insect pests, into a trap where they can then be poisoned.
Like the things that you get if you have meal moths or something like that,
right,
in your kitchen.
Right, precisely. Now, it turns out because these pheromone molecules are relatively, I would say, unstable, so they're and expensive to produce, so it's difficult to use them, cover a field with them or something like that. But you can use them for trapping. And in particular, I think their widest use has been to determine how much of an infestation you might have. So you put the traps up in specific locales around the field or an orchard and then see what you trap.
Indeed. And one of the exciting things, although we're some way off, is work in Michigan to see whether they can use the lamprey pheromones to trap or kill the lampreys, which are causing such a big problem in the Great Lakes.
These are the fish with those giant mouths that you
That's
see.
Right.
They're the sort of scary-looking ones.
Indeed, just those ones. And they're really hard to get rid of. But they turn out to have pheromones, which have been identified recently. The pheromone is difficult to synthesize, but if they could get it right, then that might be a way of controlling them.
It's so funny because I think about advertising and how sex is being used to sell everything, and it sounds like in the animal world, too, that's what we're going for as well.
You betcha.
Well, Sunshine, in Brooklyn, you have a question for our scientists.
Yeah, I am curious. Is it possible that pheromones can mutate? For example, if, you know, you were talking about how opposites attract and sort of you want something of that is different, and then you have your offspring, which, you know, it come out better because it's too opposite. Do pheromones mutate if you, say, spend long periods of time with a group of women or your husband or whoever?
Well, mutations, in the truest sense of the word, require generation time. So there has to be some reproduction. That is, an individual wouldn't normally undergo any kind of mutation. You might see a change in some pheromone composition. For example, the change in a blend may change over many generations, and this can cause, in fact, speciation. So as Professor Wyatt mentioned, there are 140 kinds of moths, separate species of moths, that use these different blends of pheromones, and they have presumably evolved over the years, their biochemical processes to change the blends slightly, and so they become independent species. What can also happen, of course, is that the receptors for the pheromones in a particular critter can evolve over time. But again, these take generational time, so I'm not sure if I've really answered the question there.
We have about a minute left. I'd like to ask each of you what you're hoping to see in this field over the next 5, 10 years. What are the breakthroughs that you're hoping for? Dr. Farstein, I'll start with you.
Well, one of our great interests are the receptors for the pheromones, in fact. And there are these large families of receptors. These are proteins, excuse me, which act as a sort of a lock, and the pheromones act as a kind of a key. And if they fit, then they activate them and cause a cell to become active and send a signal to the brain.
And are these in our noses?
So these are in our noses. We have a separate but independent system for detecting these pheromones called the vomeronasal system, at least in most other animals. It seems to be vestigial in humans. And so we'd like to know about these receptors and how they've evolved over time and a change in different species.
And Dr. Wyatt, we just have a few seconds left, but how about for you? What are you hoping to find out?
Well, it'll be somebody else doing the research, but I'm looking forward to reading that the first human pheromone has conclusively been identified. That will be fabulous.
Is that because this is not your area is more animal research rather than...
Indeed, yeah.
Although I guess we're animals too, but you just don't focus on the human animals.
No, which is why I'm waiting for somebody to do it.
And in terms of the two of you, you have very different areas of focus, but how do you work together? What is it that you find out that helps the other?
Well, what I'm interested in is how pheromones evolve, and the crucial thing is how they're perceived in the nose. And so I'm always interested in Professor Feierstein's work on receptors, because that's the crucial stage.
And Dr. Feierstein, thank you so much for coming in. I've been speaking with Dr. Stuart Feierstein, who is at Columbia University, and Dr. Tristram Wyatt, who is on the phone from Oxford University. We have been talking about pheromones. Thanks to everyone who has called in as well.
Thank you.
Leonard returns to the show on Monday. He'll speak with Burson Marseller CEO Mark Penn about microtrends. Then we'll go over the results of this weekend's election in Kurdistan. Also, our summer reading series Underappreciated returns with a look at the novel Alamut by the Slovenian author Vladimir Bartol and author Rafael Iglesias on his new novel A Happy Marriage. Plus, three medical researchers talk about the challenges of developing drugs for pharmaceutical companies. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Nishik, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Sherry Shen, Adam Delahenty, Drew Katchen, and contributing producer Bonnie Lefebvre. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Julie Burstein, in for Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.